But up first, as we all know, hindsight is 20/20 vision. And as it turns out, 20/20/20 vision isn't so much about hindsight as about forethought, and specifically about how green our cities are. It's a new national initiative, and I'm joined today in the studio by two of its ambassadors. Josh Byrne, you may know from his role as a presenter on Gardening Australia. He's also an environmental scientist. And Candice Delaney is senior research consultant at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Look, it's great to have you both with me. This is an extraordinary initiative. Josh, set it up for us. Firstly, why the third 20? 20/20/20 vision is just greedy.
Well, look, we're looking to increase the amount of green space, that is vegetated area, in urban centres by 2020. And it's all about recognising the vast benefits that greenery in urban environments in particular brings to our well-being and the livability of our cities and towns. And so we need to set a goal if we're going to get there.
So just to clarify, Josh, what are we talking about when we talk about green urban space? I mean, are we talking about how tree-lined our streets are? Are we talking about parks? Is it a combination of all those factors?
Well, we're really talking about all green space, but there's a focus on getting trees back into the urban landscape in particular for the many benefits they bring around shading and biodiversity, but it's also plants, shrubs, grassed areas, ideally well-maintained green spaces that do help with shading, with coolness, biodiversity, and nice spaces to interact with.
Candice, I know you've worked on a specific part of the 20/20/20 vision. I'm never going to be able to say that without stumbling over my words. You've worked on a specific kind of project within it called Where Are All the Trees? Tell us about that and what it tells us about how we're measuring up on green urban space so far.
Sure. Well, we joined the 20/20/20 vision to basically provide a benchmark, a baseline, if you like, for our current level of tree cover in 139 areas, local government areas across Australia. So because the ultimate aim of the program is to increase our tree cover, urban green spaces, by 2020, we have to know our starting point. So that was the aim of our project.
So are we falling short? I mean, the project and the aim to increase it by 20% suggests that we're not quite doing as well as we might. What did your research reveal?
Look, there was a lot of variation. It was a national project, so it's important to remember that Australia is a very large country and we have a very diverse climate, geography, and these very much impact the type of vegetation distribution of trees, particularly in our urban areas. So it's less meaningful to compare states and territories as local areas that are similar. So we found in some local governments there was tree cover of less than 10%. And in other areas over 55. So remembering those variations and thinking about what the characteristics of your local government area and how that could compare with other areas is a better comparison and a better benchmark.
I completely get what you're saying about comparisons being kind of not terribly helpful or odious. So obviously my next question reveals me to be a base human being, but were there any capital cities that particularly excelled in this area?
Look, Sydney did surprisingly well. There were no LGAs that had tree cover of less than...
Sorry, LGA?
Local government areas.
Right.
Apologies.
No.
Of less than 10%, like some other areas. But in saying that, there's still a lot of improvement that can be done. A lot of LGAs fall within the 10 to 20% tree cover, which suggests we can really improve that standing.
So I need you both to set up for me why this matters. Apart from property values and kind of aesthetic benefit of having nice leafy suburbs, Josh, you know, what are the top line reasons why this is important?
Well, there are really probably three key reasons that I think we can focus on for the point of discussion. Number one, and again, this is all backed by now a significant amount of research done, not just here in Australia, but also around the world, because, you know, many major cities around the world are dealing with a similar issue, in that we can now see that access to good quality green space is good for people's health and well-being. We can also see that there are very important urban biodiversity benefits that come from increased green space. And then also there are benefits to energy efficiency and just how our cities run as ecosystems around using less energy because the cities are cooler, and also managing our stormwater in particular when our stormwater design is integrated with plants, basically, to work more like natural systems.
And so Talk to me a little bit on the energy front about, I've come across when preparing for today, this fabulous idea of urban heat islands, which is the name of my ska band, as a staggering coincidence. Tell me what an urban heat island is and why this is a significant thing to measure.
Sure. Well, cities, by their very nature, are made up of heavy materials. We're talking asphalt, we're talking concrete, we're talking bricks. And that warms up during the day and stays warmer and cools down slower than surrounding green spaces. So, for example, a surrounding rural hinterland around a city. Now, the issue is, over a prolonged heat period, that heat's retained, and it can soon get to a point where it starts to make cities tough places to live, and during extreme events can push things over the threshold where heat-related illness really starts to become a problem. And we've seen this documented in Melbourne in particular over the last couple of summers. So the idea is, how can we sort of look at redesigning our cities? And one of the most effective ways to do that is getting more tree canopy into these cities, knowing that they help shade these hard spaces. Also, they transpire, which helps sort of cool spaces down, to sort of try and counteract that urban heat island effect.
Candice, is it a seesaw effect? The more green space, the smaller or fewer the urban heat islands?
Look, definitely. There's a lot of research, as Josh was saying, showing the strong relationship between cooler areas and tree cover. We've recently been doing a lot of work with Penrith City Council, a council in Western Sydney, who are, you know, facing extreme heat and increasing heat as we get hotter days, and also as we start to remove the natural cooling features from our urban areas. So part of the work we're doing with Penrith is to look at where their heat islands are, the intensity of their heat islands, and also how we can devise strategies to really start to cool these areas down, which, as Josh said, really comes down to broad canopy tree cover and allowing water to penetrate the ground, so not having our rainfall just go into stormwater runoff.
Josh, I'm curious about what the kind of innovative ways of doing this and achieving these targets are, because obviously one of the other pressures is growing urban density and higher density living in our cities. How do you both retain and build on the kind of green spaces as we're cramming more and more people into our cities?
Look, that's a very, very good point. And one of the big trends we're seeing in cities all around Australia is this increased densification. And I think it's important to remember that even though this can be a contentious process, because people see, you know, more people squeezed into less space, and often the conflict with existing landscapes and mature trees being taken down, which is clearly not a good thing, we need to remember that we need to put a growing population somewhere. And smart, clever, well-planned densification is a much better outcome than continued urban sprawl and all the downsides to strain on infrastructure and munching up, you know, important agricultural land. So densification is important, but it's got to be done well. And it's got to be done with some very clever thought and careful planning on how we can not only just maintain the types of existing tree canopy arrangements that we have, but if mature trees do have to come down in some scenarios as we change sort of urban form, how do we get clever, and how can we offset that? By firstly setting ourselves very clear urban canopy targets, and that's one of the great things that, you know, as a starting point, that the work that Candice and the team have done. For the first time, at least there is a benchmark. We know where we stand, and the report has indeed put forward that further detailed work needs to be done on an area-by-area basis, but at least people are thinking about benchmarks now. So once we move on from setting benchmarks, what are some of the strategies? There's a huge amount of work being done, obviously, around things like green walls and green roofs, but the thing I always try and flag is, yes, that's great, but they come at a cost, and in some areas, they're a very suitable strategy. But we can also look towards how we can just understand the appropriate tree species selection opportunities, better understand how trees need to be maintained in urban environments, and really see how, despite spaces getting tighter, how we can still find the right tree for the right spot and allow it to do its work.
These sound like terrific practical solutions, and I don't want to kind of typecast urban planners as kind of evil money-grabbing people, but how hard a sell is this? I mean, how much are you finding that local government, that local communities are embracing the kind of push that that you guys are pushing for in your ambassadorial role?
Well, I think in my experience, it's very hard to find someone who will disagree with you that increasing urban green space is not a good thing. I mean, the benefits are clear, and people like to be around green, attractive, cool and shady places. The trick comes down to communication, common understanding of the problem, and particularly in relation to increased urban densification. How we move through the planning process, through the design process, and indeed the construction process, how the various players can understand the opportunities and work together to get a good outcome, and how the community can be part of that conversation. I would hazard to guess that it would be the expectation of most people in the broader community that we would work towards increasing green spaces.
Candice, notwithstanding Josh's scepticism about the powerful anti-tree lobby, I'm just curious, in your experience working with local councils, you mentioned Penrith in Sydney before, what kind of take-up have you had?
Look, I think it's going to take leadership in this space, and it's also going to take collaborations with state government, with developer groups, and like Josh said, to engage the community, because really this is a wide-scale problem that's only going to get worse. So unless we start to, you know, think outside the square and really look towards local governments to show the way and to facilitate change, then, you know, we're going to keep systematically creating heat islands. And I think particularly on our urban fringes, as we see populations grow and urban areas expand quite dramatically, and with that comes vegetation loss, we have to be having multiple stakeholders involved, because one group can't do it alone.
One of the things that really impresses me about this plan is the way it came together and that idea of stakeholders, in that it seems like a genuinely crowdsourced kind of process that brings in cross-disciplinary experts and kind of a brains trust, if I understand, about 500, is that right, Josh?
Well, it's certainly up. My understanding is it's around the 250-plus partners at the moment involved. But you're absolutely right. It's an extremely innovative, collaborative campaign.
Well, look, as the country's largest urban greening network and an extraordinary demonstration of how local work can have a genuinely national impact, it's a really exciting project. Congratulations to you both. And I optimistically look forward to you replacing this program with the 30-20-30 vision program at some point afterwards. It's very exciting. I've been speaking with Josh Byrne and Candice Delaney. They're part of the 20-20-20 vision project. Details are up on our website. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN and across the Asia Pacific on Radio Australia. Coming up, I'm talking legumes, but first it's time for some reviews.